Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I know you're really busy and you have lots of choices out there, so I thank you from the bottom of my heart for tuning in once again to Voices of the Sacred Feminine and being a part of our sacred family, which is a growing international community. And I have to say, don't ever forget, you're most definitely the gas in my tank. The emails I get from you keep me going even when times are rough. And if you like that cut opening tonight's show, it was called Veil of Inanna from a great group out of Las Vegas, Nevada called Zingaya. Well, I hope you enjoyed the summer. For me, it was a real roller coaster ride. You might have heard my husband, Roy, had a heart attack right after the 4th of July. That threw us for a loop, took the starch out of me, and had me hanging on by my fingernails. And you know what? I got a real taste up close and personal of how employers can really be callous when you need your job most. Makes me all the more determined to keep fighting for social justice. Well, that was the down part of the roller coaster ride, but there was an upside, too. I signed a contract for my third book with John Hunt Publishing and Goddess Calling, Inspirational Messages and Meditations of Sacred Feminine Liberation Theology will be out in early 2014. You know, I actually got offered the contract the day Roy had the heart attack. Can you imagine if that wasn't the most emotional day? Let me tell you. And just when I thought I couldn't manage another day, I got the chance to take some time off work and sit by a pool for a few days. I recharged my batteries floating on that lazy river at a hotel in Las Vegas. My inspiration even started to flow again, and I wrote my recent blog entry on Blogger, How Life is Like a Lazy River. I'm really hooked on this lazy river concept, I got to tell you. You know, there's even a website where you can go to find where there are either water parks or hotels that have not just a pool but a lazy river. So much better than just floating on a raft in the pool. You're actually pulled along gently, slowly. It was fabulous. You should check that out if you're thinking of something different and inexpensive to do to entertain yourself or to recharge your batteries. And last night, Roy and I had a date night. Tuesday is discount night at the movies near us, and we went to a double feature. We saw Riddick, followed by Insidious, Chapter 2. And you know what? I really like that Insidious franchise. I caught Insidious 1 on TV, then went to the movies for Chapter 2, and I haven't seen such a good scary movie since Bruce Willis in The Sixth Sense all those years ago. You know, The Sixth Sense really tricked me. And I'm not going to be a spoiler and give it away if you haven't seen it. So definitely rent it. It's probably on Netflix or somewhere. And I love being tricked and not knowing what's going to happen next. And The Sixth Sense was definitely a doozy. So both Insidious and The Sixth Sense, they get my vote. So much better than those hack-em-up movies with all the gratuitous gore. Much smarter movies. Though I have to say, I will admit that the very first, Friday the 13th movie still has the power to make my hair stand up on the back of my neck and on my arms. And yes, the Goddess Conference in Malibu was last week, but I'll tell you more about that later, so stay tuned. We'll probably do that after we cross the threshold at the middle of the show. But getting back to my new book coming out, Goddess Calling, messages and meditations of liberation theology. You know, in ancient times, Christianity was thought of as liberation theology. Slaves and the poor clung to it, and it inspired them to endure their plight, to maybe feel empowered, to think that, you know, they had something to look forward to after death, I guess. You've probably heard Matthew Fox and I talk about how people in Latin America were using Christianity as liberation theology, but the Reagan administration, the Vatican, the CIA, they all tried to thwart that. They didn't want the masses empowered. Well, I am trying to get people to realize the sacred feminine carries that message of liberation to thwart patriarchy, and that's what my book will be about. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll let you know when it's out on the shelves, and I might read some excerpts now and then to tease you here on the show. But let's get to tonight's guest without any further delay. First up, I have Ivanka Brothen with me. She's written the book Rituals and Sacred Stone, Yeshua and Miriam, Priest and Priestess, King and Queen. We'll be talking about Jesus and Mary Magdalene, how religion was different in their time than it is now, how they were part of the new paradigm shift of love. Ivanka has a lot of ideas about this famous couple to share with us, and I think it's important that we rethink, you know, this, I guess if you want to call it mythology or this story, these archetypes. We can look at it all sorts of ways. Then crossing the threshold into the second half of the show, Isadora Forrest is back with us. Tonight, she's going to continue chatting a little bit about Mary Magdalene as part of the old mystery schools. Then we'll get into Isis as our primary focus, as a goddess of initiation. What we know about that, were the Roman mysteries Egyptian at all? How did that aspect follow Isis into the Western esoteric traditions? And how Isis can be the initiatrix for us today? But let's get to Ivanka, because she's been patiently waiting to chat with us. Let me tell you a bit about her before we get going. She was born in Norway and grew up on an island in the Oslo Fjord. Her mother was a Rosicrucian and encouraged free thinking. She went to a Lutheran high school and was a member of a youth church choir where they discussed the Bible with curiosity and a critical mind that young people have usually before they get it, you know, squashed out of them sometimes. She found out very early that what the Bible said about Mary Magdalene didn't seem to tell the whole story, and she made a commitment at the tender age of 15 to tell Mary's real story. She came to the U.S. at the age of 20 and went to the Maharishi International University in Iowa, where she practiced transcendental meditation, learned advanced techniques which helped her develop a lively inner life and a beginning understanding of the laws of physics that govern the spiritual world. In 1980, she was married. She moved to DeKalb, Illinois, had four kids. All the while, she continued studying the works of Henry Lincoln, Graham Hancock, Lawrence Gardner. I read those guys, too, and like what they do. They gave her insight into the ancient world and a peek into the mysteries they contained. And at the same time, she read Carolyn Miss, Margaret Starbird, Barbara Han Clo, and she developed her understanding of the spiritual world, which she found herself experiencing more clearly. Her first book grew out of frustration as she studied the history of the church. It's called Sex on the Altar, a Fairy Tale for Grown-Ups. We're going to have to talk about that. And it proposes that God has a problem. He's missing his wife. Huh. We've known that all along. In 2007, she traveled to France to visit the places that claimed Mary Magdalene had been there. She stayed there 5 weeks in the Languedoc, I think that's how you pronounce it, area in Provence, France. That gave her the personal experience she felt she needed to sit down and write this book. Again, the title is Rituals in Stone, published in March by Balboa Press. I think she's going to be changing the title to Mary Magdalene, Her Life as Divine Priestess. That sounds much more intriguing and probably more concise. Writing about Mary Magdalene, merging with her life and her story, deepened her inner life, brought her into closer connection to the guides, spirits, and masters of the unseen world. She says she's grateful for the privilege of being given this task. She knows that further authorship will reflect the body of knowledge she's developed. And she wants us to understand that we have masters, guides, and spirits who are eager to help us And we always like that self-help stuff, so we will most definitely get into that as well. So, Venka, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
So first, you know, let me say, as I was reading your biography, it reminded me of something. You know, so much of what we learn in the mainstream is designed to disempower us, to keep history from us, to keep us from maybe what real truths are. You know, I think once you understand that, you know, you look at history, the media, patriarchal institutions, capitalism, all of it, you know, the very structures that seem to hold the world together very differently. You know, quite frankly, at least for me, I look at all of those as, you know, oppressive and exploitive liars, if you will. I know that might sound harsh, but I don't know. Do you agree at all?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I think the Catholic Church has probably been the best promoter of how to keep people being good sheep.
Right.
Good sheep that could be easily manipulated. And the whole notion of that we need the church or even the priesthood to communicate with God is ludicrous for one thing, but it's also been very effective in their,
right.
in what they were trying to do.
Right, right.
So,
yeah, you think about the damage the church has done so many people, you know, from the pedophile priest to, you know, subjugating women to this, you know, all of this disempowerment.
Yeah.
Really, it's unconscionable when, you know, spirituality is supposed to be something that uplifts you and gets you closer to God.
Yeah, yeah. And also they've done an incredible job about segregating or separating out other people's form of belief. So other mm-hmm. religions become then a bad way to God in a way, or enemies in many ways.
Right.
In many communities, if you weren't of the Catholic Church, even a Baptist would be an enemy, which
right.
doesn't make any sense at all, because they're all Christians and they should
well,
all be
you know,
doing
and,
the same
well,
thing.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm mixing Jesus with religion. You know, maybe we shouldn't do that. That's a mistake, you know, because
well,
Jesus is about love, and so often religion isn't.
Very often it isn't, and that is the sad part. And that's also why I found it so fascinating to study more of the ancient history, where you learn about the mystery schools that existed in all the way around in Europe and around the Mediterranean Sea, and they're old schools where you could learn about how to work with the gods. You weren't worshiping the gods; you were working with the gods. And all these different mystery schools had different things that they were teaching, different things that were their specialty, and they had great respect for each other. You could visit another mystery school and say, I have learned this degree from the Serapeum in Alexandria, and if you then showed up at Ephesus, they would know exactly who you are and what you were believing and what you knew. And they would welcome
well, let me
you.
Ask you, Venka, because, you know, we hear, you know, we lost so much knowledge when the Serapeum, you know, or the Library of Alexandria burned. And, you
yeah.
know, we know the Vatican is hoarding all sorts of great stuff. These things that you're talking about, how were you able to access this information? Because, you know, I might not, you know, just might not be that well read, but is it actually out there, or did you have to sort of put the puzzle pieces together and make some assumptions, or, you know, maybe some of the folks we mentioned in your biography, the guys that you like to read that, you know, I mentioned too, Graham Hancock and them. How
mm-hmm.
do you know what the ancient mystery schools really taught?
Well, you need to build your knowledge. So I built by studying the history. So you study the Roman Empire and study all the stuff that they had to say about things. Then you study the people who have a historic way of looking at how people lived at that time. Then you can study the philosophies that came out of different areas and start to get a framework for what was going on in their time frame. Like, just to give a little example, Plato and Socrates lived 300 years before Christ. So at the time of Christ and Mary Magdalene, that then had a lot of education, Plato's ideas were old ideas that they were discussing, just so that we get a little bit of a framework of what was going on then. And in the Roman Empire, you could travel freely within, and you know how big that was. It covered the whole coast of the Mediterranean Sea and pretty far north, almost up to through Germany and up to Denmark. They didn't get to all the way to India, but they went pretty far.
And yeah, all into Turkey that whole framework, and all of that area. Yeah.
Yeah, within that whole framework, you could travel pretty safely. And the Romans didn't really care about the mystery schools. That was kind of, they could continue on their own. That was fine with them. So they continued. And to find the knowledge about what it was, well, you have to, at least this is what I did, you get as much framework of historical claimed facts. And then you have to use your intuition a little bit, because there will be things that are hinted at, things that are, you find a sentence where something is mentioned, and then you find that that will lead to that this and this is true. And and then you use your intuition to fill in the blanks. And
I've
had to take the liberty to do that.
You know, there was everybody was trying to figure out what did they do in the Eleusinian mysteries. You know, and now we think we know. You know, we think they used hallucinogenic drugs, and maybe the goddess appeared, and it was all about rebirth and death, and, you know, like the cycle of the seed as a metaphor for the cycle of life and all of that. But, you know, we didn't really know that, you know?
No, and you need to have a certain frame of mind yourself before you're willing to understand that. Because if you go there, if you go into this stuff just looking for bare facts, you're going to miss so much. You need to go in there with an open mind, where the subjective experience has validation, where going on an inner journey is something that's hard to describe than what actually happened, but that is a valid experience, and it's an experience of the unseen world and of the gods and of whatever people have experienced. But in our time now, we have such a tendency to not really value that. We want an outside absolute fact to, you know, we want a document that says that with a signature on it.
And with some people, even if you have that, they won't believe it. But then you have the flip side of that. So much of that is written is really worthless and will take you down the wrong path, you know. So it's difficult. You could spend your whole entire life just trying to figure this stuff out, and
absolutely.
You know.
But that is what life is about, isn't it? To dive into the mysteries and find your. And I think that's what we do as we evolve. That we build our own framework. We build our own truths that are the absolute truths for ourselves. But they might be just for ourselves. And then from there we build further, and we'll find that the spiritual world has structure. There is structure. There are laws of physics that govern that world, and it's up to us to find that and experience that.
Well,
I mean,
speak
even
to that a little bit. Is that something you can sort of talk about briefly in a nutshell? Because we don't want to get too far off track.
Sure.
Was there like a universal thing the mystery schools taught, and what you were just talking about, you know, what the physics of it?
Right. Well, we can talk about the physics of as you sow, so shall you reap, which is then the physics of karma. What you put out is what you get back, which we now have a very, very strong understanding of. That's one little law of physics that's not really, you know, physics as in an object moving. That is physics using the energies of interactions between people. And that's the kind of laws that govern the spiritual world and the energy work between us. Now, to get back to what they actually taught in the mystery schools, again, this thing of knowing how to work with the gods. You don't worship the gods, you work with the gods. So you use plant material, like you mentioned, hallucinogenic drugs, but also just herbs that you could use as a cream to put on your body would change things. This is something we probably will get into a little bit later, but the journey of Osiris, I know your next guest will talk more about this as well, which was very established as a mythological concept among the Egyptians, where Osiris would then be given an opportunity, given a technique to travel into the unseen world. And we have now examples of that, like from Shakespeare with Juliet, who took a potion and was dead for 3 days, and then she wakes up. And we've accepted that, that was possible.
So it's sort of like the astral projection or something, maybe.
Well, maybe that, or maybe similar to what Lazarus did. You know, Lazarus was considered dead, and that he was woken up. It's
right.
considered one of Jesus' miracles, but it could also have been one of these initiations that he was sent into. The mistake was just that he was found by some people who didn't understand.
Right.
So
right.
It became looked like and looked at as something else.
But right.
to do that, to do that journey of Osiris, you need to have the priestess who knows what to do, where you need to prepare your body with your what you've been eating or not eating. You need to purify yourself. You need to then have the right herbs available. Both.
Do we know how to do that today? Or is the
I don't think so. I don't think we really know how to do that, but I think people are experimenting to some degree
mm-hmm.
with these kind of things, and which is also very interesting.
Right.
Among more, well, liberal people who are thinking more in sort of a wider way of experiencing life, I think a lot of people are experimenting with this and trying to find ways. So,
yeah.
And I think that's what
you
knew how to do.
Working with the gods, I guess you could say that's working with the natural elements. I mean, we do that with astrology. You know, we do that with, you know, doing magic on the waning or waxing moon or the full moon. Those sorts of things, too, is what you're referring to?
Absolutely. And another big thing that they did was they had these festivals at the solstices and the equinoxes and at certain days of the year where they would play out the mythology of their time. So the story of Inanna and Tammuz, which
mm-hmm.
is like another story of going into the underworld and going through 7 initiations and coming back to the world where his bride is waiting for him. That story was then enacted and played out in front of people. So the stories of their mythology became a part of their daily life. And instead of having religion where you believe in a god outside of yourself, this is more like understanding psychology so that
mm-hmm.
you understand that this is a power I can call upon because it is latent within me. Like to go to Greek mythology, like if you want Athena, you want the clarity of mind that she represents, you call upon Athena within yourself to awaken that power within you.
Right,
and once
right.
mythology is understood that way, it's not like Athena lived somewhere and you know was an
yeah.
existing person. It's that she's symbolizing that power within each of us.
Right,
and
like an archetype
But
absolutely.
When you live with that, I mean, even as archetypes, we have a tendency to put the archetypes outside of ourselves and let them live in
True.
Fairy tales and things. Instead of seeing that each of these archetypes are part of our own psyche and how we work with that, and evolution is that you know the expression of get yourself together. It actually means pull in all the parts that are actually you that you have allowed to float about out around you in a big, you know, big mess, a big playground. Pull them all in so all these powers that are actually yours can be accessed and utilized from your center.
You explain this so well. You know, you're making me think about how Isis pulls together all the parts of Osiris.
Yes. There we have that thing. And
yeah.
and then again, think about in the time of the Egyptians, where they knew how to do operations. The surgical equipment has been found that is actually better and finer than what we have today. And they knew how to repair people. I mean, some of these mummies have holes in their heads and various things that have
yeah.
been stitched and put together again. There was even rumors that they knew how to grow a limb. If you were missing a part of your leg, you could grow that back together again.
Wow. Well, you know,
so,
Venka, I really, and you know, tell me if you disagree, but I really get the feeling that, you know, Christianity sent us into the Dark Ages, that, you know, pagans, I don't know, I just get the feeling, maybe not everybody, but maybe the ones that were literate, or maybe even not the ones that were literate, because maybe they learned through symbols, but they were more
mm-hmm.
sophisticated than we are today. Do you think that might be true, or do you think it might have just been a small group of elite?
Well, I think the whole society would have been functioning on a higher level. And we have a tendency to not really think of it like that. We think of, you know, people in olden times as barbarians, but
mm-hmm.
I don't think that was really the truth.
Right.
You can go to, and it wasn't just the around the Mediterranean Sea either. I mean, I'm in love with Alexandria and all the stories about how that functioned in that time. But you also had the Druids in Ireland who were extremely sophisticated in everything that they did. And later on, we had the Vikings who actually invented
right.
democracy and
right.
did a lot of sophisticated things. I mean, they did chop off some people that they didn't like, but generally they had a pretty high culture.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have the Native Americans who taught our forefathers, you know, something of, you know, they influenced our democracy, you know, and we
right.
think of them as heathens, you know.
Oh, it's so awful. I've actually learned more and more about Native Americans and how extremely democratic they were and how they would work together with the other tribes. I mean, obviously there were wars between tribes too, but if they were working together, you would come together in these rooms and these huts that were their ceremonial places to be, and the respect between each other was just so beautiful, the way that was used, and the, you know, the talking stick. You give
mm-hmm.
it to the one who's talking next, and they get to say their piece, and then we go on.
Right.
We don't have that respect in our society of today. We've been turned into a bunch of very cynical people.
You know what I do think we have? And you know, and I hate to, you know, but it's at the forefront of my mind, so I got to just spit it out. This, especially in America, this idea that we are so exceptional, you know,
mm-hmm.
that makes me so angry, because that's so much about ego and not really about wisdom, because we aren't exceptional, you know. We have so much of the country who doesn't even value education. You know, we have so much
yeah.
of the country that follows the, you know, the big Bible of hate mongering. You know, I mean, I think we are less sophisticated than people of ancient times. I really do. And maybe that's just my romanticized idea, but mm-hmm. I can't help it. There it is.
I'm a little careful what I say, because after all, I did grow up in Europe, and I don't want to be a European that criticizes America. After all, I've lived there. It's been my country for many, many years now. But there is a sort of bully on the playground attitude
yeah.
that's being praised. Like now, Obama is being criticized for not jumping into a war with Syria, whereas I think what he's been doing is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And to have the flexibility of stopping everything, and
mm-hmm.
if these people are willing to talk about this issue, let's go and talk about that. This is great.
You see,
let's
I feel the
talk.
Same way.
I think that's fantastic.
When Bush was confronted with new evidence, they just ignored it. You know, well, that's because
yeah.
they had an agenda. But, you know, but I know what you mean. You know, I mean,
yeah.
we should be able to be flexible and change with new evidence and not just always resort to using our big stick.
Exactly. And, well, we'll see. Right now we have, you know, the news of the new shootings that happened in Washington, D.C., which was pretty awful as well. And my question is just how many more of these do we have before we really make a big change in the gun laws? That's
right.
another one of my big issues. So
right.
my question is not just, isn't this awful? The question is more, okay, here's another one. How
right.
many more do we need before we really do something about this?
Well,
yeah.
you know, honestly, I am starting to feel like until these old white Republicans die away, that I don't know that we have much hope of changing the government. You know, they want to carry guns into Starbucks. You know, they don't care about people losing food stamps and if they starve. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's outrageous to me, the callousness and the
yeah.
ignorance and the need to dominate. I mean, I understand on a logical level it's all about fear, and but you know what? Enough is enough. I mean, let's evolve already, okay?
Evolve already. I like that. Yeah, it seems like they're ignorant, arrogant, and proud of it. And
yeah.
I can't go for that. I have a really hard time with that, because it's just a denial of history. History
yeah.
shows that the societies that really took care of their poor, took care of everybody, are the ones that survived and lived on. I mean, how
yeah.
many years were the Egyptians? 7,000, 6,000, I mean, maybe not that many, 3,000, 4,000 years? They
yeah.
took care of everybody. They made sure that they stored up. You have the stories of Joseph the dream teller, you know, that
yeah.
they stored up the food over in the good years and had then food to share with everybody in the bad years.
Right.
So
right.
they took care of everybody. And the
I need a time machine. I don't belong in this time. I don't want to be in this time.
No. We do belong. We are the ones we've been waiting for because we see the history and we see the patterns, and we are the ones speaking up. And
you're so right, but it's so hard. You know, the struggle
yes,
is so
hard
every
but
day.
But you know what? We volunteered. So here we are.
Well, let's get back to Jesus and Mary, and I could talk to you about all of this all day, but I promised my listeners that's what we were going to talk about. So religion. You said in the information you sent me that religion today is practiced and experienced differently than 2,000 years ago. Was there more to that than what you've already said, that people lived it every day, it wasn't something outside themselves?
Well, the thing of that you work with the gods instead of worshiping the gods, that I think is very important. And I also think that we have to acknowledge how Jesus was teaching, that he would tell the stories, but they were understood at different levels according to where people were in their understanding. And he had an inner circle of people that were that he gave the initiations to, and then the next circle of people that were given the information that they could handle. And then he had a further out circle of people who were given them the beautiful big parables and hoping that they would get something out of that. And his cue in the way he's saying things is those with ears to hear will understand. That's the line that's being said. And that usually meant this is a much deeper story.
Can you give an example maybe of one of those stories that had different layers or levels to it?
Well, let's see. Nothing comes to mind right now. But even his speech on the mound, you know, the speech on the mound that he did where he says, blessed are the meek, which I think has been translated in kind of weird and goofy ways. But on that one where there were 5,000 people surrounding him, he still managed to speak so that everybody felt that they had something to take with them home, something, some story that was theirs. And everybody had then a little different story.
Do you believe he really did all those miracles? I mean, like the loaves and the fishes and all of that, or do you think it was just, you know, Jesus propaganda?
That's an interesting story, interesting way of looking at it. I think he knew how to manipulate physicality. I think he knew how to do that, but that was part of knowing how to work with the physical world, work with the spiritual world, and make things appear. And I think he actually knew how to do that kind of stuff. But I think it has more to do with physics than it has to do with, you know, abracadabra miracle. Mm-hmm. It has more to do with really, really understanding how to work with the spiritual world. And if you have five fish already, to duplicate that might not be so difficult.
Well, if you live in the time of Star Trek and you have one of those, what do they call it?
It looks like a microwave machine, and you ask it to make a, you know, Christmas dinner, and it will make it for you.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was called now. but you know, I guess I just can't imagine him really being able to take five fish and turn it into however many it says, you know? I mean, that even seems like beyond the laws of physics, but unless it's physics, we just don't understand yet.
It could also be that story is intended in a different way. After all, his symbol was a fish. That was the symbol that he went under. He was the paradigm shift of going from the time of Aries to the time of Pisces. And his symbol is the fish. But he is the sacrificial lamb, which is then the symbol from the previous time when the Aries is the ram, the big male sheep. And he is then the little lamb, taking people into the new age of the Pisces. So his symbol was the fish. So if you have then that on that hill you had 5,000 people who heard his words, then they all became fish who went on out in the world and spread the knowledge of the fish.
So it wasn't really a little literal story of a lunch. It was maybe more him feeding them the new paradigm.
Yeah, exactly. So the more I studied all this, the more I found that the stories expanded something tremendous. Like, I've always been fascinated with the story of John the Baptist and his head on a platter. And I always felt that there was a lot more to that story. So when I started studying just the history of the Roman Empire and what was going on, suddenly you get a much larger story that expands tremendously. You have Herod the Great, who just before Jesus finished up the big temple in Jerusalem, he built it for the second time. Now, Herod the Great is not Jewish. He's actually put in there by the Romans to be the king of Judea in their place. But he did it to make the Jewish people be happier because they were not behaving the way other populations had. When the Romans took over other places, they kind of just absorbed them into the Roman Empire. The Judaic people didn't want to be absorbed at all, so they were constantly protesting about this. So Herod the Great built a new temple for them to make them happy. Now, Herod the Great died, and he has two sons. You have Herod Antipas and Herod Philip. And the country was divided in two parts. So Herod Philip gets to live in Syria, whereas Herod Antipas lives in Jerusalem, and then Samaria is actually a little country that's between the two. The story goes on that Philip married Herodias, and she's mentioned somewhere in the Bible as well. And there was a whole cult around her. She was a phenomenal, fascinating person who was educated in Ephesus and took that knowledge with her. So she marries Philip, she has a child, and that's Shalome that we hear about in the story. Now, Herod Antipas had to marry a princess of a nearby country before his father died, who he doesn't like at all. So in the middle of all this, he wants to change his marital status. So he divorces the young princess, and he kills his brother. This is Hamlet all over. And he marries Herodias, and he forces her to marry him. So she comes to Jerusalem.
So he's marrying his sister-in-law?
His sister-in-law, because they claim that that is their tradition, that if your brother dies, you marry the widow.
But he had him killed, though. I guess it doesn't matter.
He did have him killed. There's something very subtle, like Hamlet, similar to Hamlet, to Hamlet's father, where he gets a poison in his ear, something like that, something very subtle. But Herodias has figured it out. So she comes down to Jerusalem almost by force and has her daughter with her, and she's furious and hopping mad. But she still has to be married to him. Now, John the Baptist is the one who then goes onto the temple steps and speaks out against Herod and said, this is absolutely wrong. You can't do this. Because Herod Antipas had also tried to endear himself into the temple. He wanted to be part of the temple council, which he had no business being because he was not Jewish. So he had no business being there at all, but he wanted to be part of that. So he's trying to become more Jewish. And Herodias was part Jewish and also a Roman citizen, so she was a perfect card for him to get more into the political arena in Jerusalem at the time. Now, this birthday party that he puts together, this is also biblical, that he has this big party for his birthday. And he invites all these dignitaries from around, you know, kings and queens and people from the temple and all these other various populations that lived in Jerusalem at the time, and invite them all to the palace. And sweet young Shalome, who is now his stepdaughter, who's also his niece, she wants to endear her new father because, after all, she's a young girl. She can dance. She does this beautiful dance for him. And he's totally endeared with this, and he says, ask anything you want. And then she goes to her mother, and this is now Herodias. So she asks, Mom, what should I ask for? And Herodias just grabs her daughter and says, you ask for the head of John the Baptist. And this young little girl goes back to her stepfather and doesn't really understand the depth of what this is. But she says this is what she wants. And suddenly he realizes, my gosh, they've understood this. And what is being presented at that time is not necessarily a beheaded man, a beheaded head with blood and gore and everything. It is something totally different. This is a head that has been prepared to be an oracle. It's been prepared before he died in a ritual and in a process where you make this beautiful man with all his wisdom, you make all that wisdom be in his head, and you decapitate him during a ritual and with very specific ways of doing this and stitch everything up and make it very beautiful so that this head can be awakened, on command or in a ritual situation and speak to you, and it becomes an oracle. Now, Herod Antipas, he just wanted to be a fortune teller that would tell him, you know, when to do a battle and when to do what. But to the people who really knew, as in Herodias, who was trained in Ephesus, where they did oracles like this, this meant something totally different. Because then John the Baptist is a representative of his family, of his tribe, of his people. And the oracle that he becomes is something much more powerful than just a fortune teller. It's again a bridge between the physical world and the unseen world.
and he
now
can travel
incredible.
Between.
I've never mm-hmm. heard that before, this whole idea of the oracle. I thought it was just a decapitation.
Yeah, exactly. But see what happens then when this head gets presented to this party. Everybody goes, what does he know about oracles? What does Herod know about oracles? What does he know about this is secret knowledge that hardly even the rabbis at the temple know very much about. They know that some of that existed in their tradition. But who knows how to do this in our time? And the reason Herodias asked for it was because she wanted it back. She didn't want Herod Antipas to have it because he's a mean son of a bitch, but she wanted it to have it back and give it back to Jesus and his family. After all, John the Baptist was his cousin. So, and when this head then is presented, then all the guests are going, what is going on here? What is this man doing? And what happened afterwards, the crucifixion was shortly after this party happened. And after all that, this is actually historically correct. Herod Antipas lost his total career. He was thrown out of Jerusalem. He had to be in a court case in Rome together with Herodias. They were in prison for a year before they sent him off to some off place down in Africa, someplace where he rots away. And she actually gets freed, and she takes over his estate in southern France.
Wow.
And this is historically correct. So the thing with the oracle I have put in there, but that is what fits. That is what actually fits the story. And suddenly the story becomes much more intriguing and has many more aspects to it. And it becomes a huge story that involves, you know, the whole country of Judea at the time.
Well,
and
of course,
and
it makes
mm-hmm.
sense that, you know, we're talking about a time when so many people weren't even literate. How, I mean, and, you know, anybody who's played the telephone game, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, you can see how the real story could have so easily gotten lost. I mean, you know, we see how, you know, history's being rewritten just since the Bush administration, you know, so imagine,
yes,
you know,
why
hundreds of thousands of years.
Right, right. Well, so if this story just becomes that Herod has a birthday party and Shalomi dances and she asks for the head of John the Baptist and it's delivered, you know,
right. That's,
I'm not lying. I'm saying, telling the story as it was. It's just missing all the details.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
You miss the whole context, really.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so the big question that, you know, everybody debates, do you think Jesus and Mary Magdalene were actually married?
A lot of things points to that. For one thing, the wedding in Cana, why would his mother be concerned with the wine if
mm-hmm.
it wasn't their wedding?
Yeah,
I mean,
heard
if she's
that.
Just a guest there, why on earth would she be concerned?
Right.
So that's one little hint. And then there are the things that she did. She did the anointment of his head. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And also, she goes with to the tomb. She is there at his death, and she goes with to the tomb. And that is a job that only a wife is allowed to do, to prepare the dead body.
Right.
So,
well, and there's also the thing that, you know, Jewish men were supposed to be married also.
Yeah, especially rabbis.
Yeah,
rabbis,
I mean,
were definitely
he,
supposed to be married. There would have been a big deal if he was not.
Right.
And it would have been mentioned somewhere that if he was not married.
Yeah.
So, and another interesting thing around the crucifixion and him going into the tomb is that it says, I don't know which gospel has it, but that Nicodemus and John Joseph of Arimathea brought 100 pounds of aloe vera to the tomb. Now, I find that really interesting because aloe vera, as we know, is fantastic when it comes to fixing skin wounds. If you had a burn, you put aloe vera on it, and it helps. If you had any kind of skin wound, your aloe vera would actually help you kind of almost fill in the blanks where you're missing something. But it certainly is not something that was used for a dead body. So
you're thinking, you sort of follow the thought of some of the stories out there that he really didn't die, that maybe he went on to southern France with Mary?
Uh-huh. Very lucky that he showed up there because there aren't so many legends about him in southern France. He shows up more in England. There we have much more stories about that he was actually there. Now, maybe he didn't necessarily die, but he could have gone on the journey of Osiris, and they could have arranged for that was their plan. They knew he would be crucified. They knew that the Romans would treat him like that because he had been a rebel for a long time, and they knew exactly what was going to happen. But if they put him through it as an initiation process, then he would appear dead, and he would also wake up at the appointed time if he was treated properly.
Right,
now,
right.
The brutality of the Romans didn't exactly help the story. He was probably weakened quite severely because of that. But most likely, he did survive. And, you know, for the Romans, there's nothing. The only thing worse than a dead hero the only thing worse than a hero is a dead hero. But even worse is a hero that's not even dying properly, but showing up again. So
right,
because
then he would have really looked like he was a supernatural or God.
Yes, exactly. But to them who were the initiates, who knew how to do this, it is not miraculous. It is something that they were very well prepared how to do. And they knew how to do this. And Mary Magdalene was the one who knew the herbs. And she had studied at the Serapeum in Alexandria and knew how to use herbs for this purpose, both as a potion for him to drink, but also to prepare his skin and his body to go through all this.
So we're really saying he maybe faked his death.
In a way, yes. But it satisfied a whole bunch of things. One thing, it satisfied the Romans' need to kill him, because he was a rebel and because he wanted to. There were people with weaponry around him. He was not just a peaceful person trudging along the roads of Galilee. There were people with weapons that were around him that wanted him to be the next military leader and wanted to overthrow the Romans.
Yeah, we would have considered him a terrorist today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the proof of that is actually biblical as well, where he's in Gethsemane Garden and Judas comes and gives him the sign that this is the man you want. The Romans sent a cohort of soldiers to get him. A cohort is 800 soldiers. Now, if they were just looking for one little peaceful rabbi, 10 would have done the job, you know? But
right.
800 soldiers is what they sent in there. And Jesus had a bunch of followers who were very military trained. They had swords. Even Peter had a sword. You know, he cut off the ear of one of the high priests. So we know that there were lots of weaponry among them, and they were hiding behind the trees and all over the place in Gethsemane Garden that night. So what Jesus actually prevented was a total bloodshed, because they could have attacked each other, and everybody
right.
could have died. I mean, they would have killed some Roman soldiers as well.
Right.
And
right.
to top it off, Peter does this hysterical thing of cutting off the high priest's ear, and Jesus has to do his little miracle thing of plunking the ear back on and patting him nicely on the side of his head and say, you'll be all good. And then preventing all this from happening, and he walks freely with them. And the Romans only wanted him because they couldn't really figure out all these others, I guess. But that was a pretty, very significant detail about just the number of soldiers coming.
I can also see how, you know, they would not want history to be written that Jesus was, how would you say, you know, that Jesus had this military power. Military is the right word. You know, they would, you know, I don't know, I could see where that, they would want to get sweep that beneath the sands of history, you know.
Yes, exactly. And
because,
not to mention,
I mean,
very powerful
church,
woman next to him. Yeah.
Well, in this new church that comes up, you know, they want sheep. They don't want people who are going to challenge anything.
Right.
You know, challenge the authority that's in place.
Yes. And that was and. Jesus did not necessarily teach them to be. He did say, "Give the other cheek if people are fighting," but that still didn't mean that everybody should just sort of surrender to everything else. He was teaching self-empowerment, but self-empowerment from a very spiritual point, where you teach that enlightenment is a growing process, where you include more light inside your body. You make every cell of your body have a spark of light in it, and that's a very physical process. It's not.
Right.
It's another not abracadabra thing, and it's not that you leave your body and become just the spirit floating about and, you know, sorry about that, we have weather going on in Chicago. That's not what it means either. It means that you infuse your body with light, and after a while, your body will reflect that, and that is what he did. So he looked like light as he walked about, because he had accomplished that. He was enlightenment, and that is what he was teaching us, how to get to that point. Yeah.
Well, you know, that makes me think of in the Kabbalah, they teach about you receive the light, this emanation theology.
Yes.
So, it's sort of a new twist on that, too, as well.
Absolutely. And Kabbalah, after all, that's Jewish wisdom,
mysticism.
So he knew all about that.
Right.
There's another piece that I like to throw in there when we're talking about enlightenment, and that is that they knew a lot about how to use gold, the metal gold, in their work, because gold can hold consciousness, and gold, you can make it into a white powder. You might have heard about this when you make it into monatomic gold. It's now becoming a very interesting piece of study in our time, what that can do, because it behaves differently in according to laws of physics. It levitates. It does a whole bunch of interesting things, and it's not that hard to make. It's not that difficult to make gold go into that format.
Hmm.
They could actually figure out how to do that, and it's some theories that was part of the Ark of the Covenant, that was the powder that was in the bottom of the box that actually made it do very dangerous things. But
wow.
It's also a powder that you can ingest. You can eat it, and it will bring you to enlightenment. And at their time, the Nazareans were the ones who knew how to do this. And they knew how to make a piece of a kind of bread with this gold inside it. And the bread looked like little cones. And you see it actually in Egyptian pictures, where you see them carry these cones around and serve them to the king. But this is what Jesus actually did at the Last Supper. He served a bread that was specifically made with this gold inside. And then after 40 days, remember that at Pentecost, all the disciples suddenly had extra abilities and a little flame above their head and could speak other languages. It's because ingesting gold in that format will physically bring enlightenment to your body.
It's, wow.
Yeah, this is something I learned more through Graham Hancock's books, but also anything else I could find about this, and also the modern science of today looking into monatomic gold and what it can do. Gives you information, and the fact that this powder, white powder, can levitate and lifts with it the spoon that it's sitting on, that is actually very interesting. So how about that we take this white powder and we put it on a big rock and we make the rock float and levitate, and then we push the rock a little bit and we put all these rocks together and we build a pyramid. How about that?
Wow.
So,
well,
yeah.
Well, you know, it makes me think, some people thought it was crazy, but I remember reading one of Shirley MacLaine's early books. I think it was Out on a Limb. And
yeah,
she was talking
one.
About the pyramids in Peru. She believed that the pyramids were put in place, the stones, through levitation.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not? See, this is a different kind of science than what we deal with today, although actually science today is dealing with monatomic gold as well and are mystified about it. And we also learned that the laws of physics work a little differently under very cold circumstances. If you're under like minus 275 Fahrenheit degrees, then suddenly things work differently, things behave differently. So there are many things about physics that we don't, in our daily life, we don't really know about. After all,
right.
We're only comfortable within like 20 degrees of weather.
Yeah,
30 degrees
yeah.
of weather, and we need to do something about it. So
going back to that idea that they were so much more sophisticated than we are.
Yes, yes. And another thing I came across was that on top of the Sinai mountain on the Arabian Peninsula, on the top of that, they found some of this white powder, and at first, the archaeologists had just found this fabulous temple on top. And this temple apparently worked with mining the gold and preparing the gold and making this gold, making it into this very particular substance that could then be used as a sort of power thing in
mm-hmm.
the temples. So the Ark of the Covenant gets it from there, and we have to stop thinking about that. There's only one Ark of the Covenant. I think there were many, and I think the knowledge about how to do that was more widespread than what we're being told.
Well, and you know, and I wonder, I don't know whether this has anything to do with anything of what you're talking about, but I can't help but think about, you know, the whole story with Moses, and he comes down from the, from the top of the mountain with the Ten Commandments, and down at the bottom is this one tribe that are still worshiping the golden calf. And I don't know, I'm just thinking about that golden calf differently now, and I've always thought that maybe they were, you know, they were worshippers maybe of Hathor, you know, or the Apis bull or something like that.
There we go. But they lived in the time of Taurus, you know? So the bull and the calf would be, the calf would be the one that brings them into the next level, just like Jesus was the sheep that goes from the ram, the time of Aries, going into the Pisces. You know, this is symbolic. And it signifies the paradigm shifts that were happening at the time.
So it almost sounds like the tribe that Moses ordered killed is the tribe that's actually more spiritually evolved.
I'm not clear. I don't think he ordered anybody killed. We had the tribes of Aaron and his brother and all his family who became the caretakers of the Ark of the Covenant. And as they learned how to work with this, that family and that line of family also became the caretakers in the temple, who knew how to work with the holiest of holies in the temple in Jerusalem.
Well, I have to admit, I didn't read this firsthand, but I was at a conference where Isaac Bonowitz was talking about Moses comes down from the temple, and one of the tribes wasn't getting on with the program, and he ordered that tribe killed. But I don't know what the name of that tribe was. But I never forgot it because I thought of the hypocrisy of it. Here he's coming down the hill with a thou shalt not kill message and has the tribe killed.
Right. They did a short process of people in Jericho and a couple of other places too on their way back to Judea. So, and Moses was not allowed in. You know, he could look at the promised land, but he never got to go in there. There are other things too about that temple, though. The temple on top of Mount Sinai. The head priest in that one was called an angel. That was the word for angel was his title. So. Now you can see how everything gets translated a little backwards. And it wasn't just that he went up there to meet God. He went up there to talk to the people at the temple. And if his people then did that golden calf, well, maybe they also just collected up all the gold that they had to produce more of this white gold that could help them in so many other ways. That became a weapon, but it also became a route to enlightenment.
Wow.
And to say something about those priests of Aaron who knew how to work with the Ark of the Covenant, their knowledge and their way of being protected to be able to work with the Ark of the Covenant, because it became a weapon. It was a very dangerous thing to do if you didn't know exactly what to do. That knowledge went down in their genealogy. So their bodies carried with it their own protection for how to use this. You know, now we think of each person as an island in so many ways. We don't see ourselves as a point in history between our ancestors and our future family. We don't see that. Mm-hmm. We think of ourselves as, you know, an individual who can do all sorts of phenomenal things. But that's of course great too. But we have to see ourselves as a number in a line of ancestors before us and a line of ancestors after us. And see our responsibility in that line of beings, because everything we do has an effect 7 generations backwards and 7 generations forwards. So whatever we do now will have an effect on what happened to our ancestors. Think about Back to the Future. When he goes back and he fixes a couple of things, he goes into his family again, and suddenly his father is a successful author, his mother looks lovely, instead of that little blowdown place that they had in the beginning. It's because he fixed something much earlier in time, and it then has an effect on his family towards the future. So we have to start to understand that this is not just a cute fairy tale. This is actually something very real, that if we go one step up in our enlightenment, in our evolution, we are affecting our families backwards and forwards. And to take that responsibility on is that is where the learning comes in. That's where you learn this This is part of the physics of the spiritual world.
And if we aren't aware of that, the consequences are incredibly great.
Yes, absolutely.
All the more reason to get it right this time, because so much is at stake.
Yes, exactly. And at least do our best. At least become more aware and learn more about these processes. I think also the more you know, the more responsibility you're given. So if you really are truly ignorant about these things, your effect will be less. Because, again, this concept of that you, you know, get yourself together, that you take all the parts of you that are floating about on the playground and you pull them together and bring them back into your center so you can use this, you have that under your control. If you don't live like that and there aren't that many parts of you and everything is kind of floating about a little bit freely, you aren't given responsibilities in the same way and you won't be able to affect things the same way. It's the more of you that you have gathered up into yourself, the more effective you will be in the things that you influence around you.
Well, that really does make more sense. So that way the coarseness of the word I'm going to use, so that way the idiot can't do too much damage, but the wise person has a bigger responsibility to affect outcomes. At least there's mercy in that in those laws of the universe, though, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, that's true. It's totally true.
Well, Venka, I see that Isadora is on the switchboard, so I don't want to keep her too long. And I know we didn't get to all of our talking points, but let me just ask you two last things. I wanted to know what happened to the Cathars and the Celts. Because it seems like you felt that, they were really carrying the sacred knowledge and maybe they got obliterated by the Romans. And the final question is, what haven't I asked you that you think listeners really need to hear? And then we'll have to sort of wrap it up.
Yes, I understand. The Cathars definitely had the knowledge because they were in southern France and they learned directly from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. That was their claim. And part of their wisdom was that they honored both men and women. So they had men and women. The priest was the couple, the man and woman together. And they understood a lot more about the laws of physics of love and how love is also a physical thing. And the physical relationship between the priest and priestess, who were the head of the congregation, would also have importance. And this was the knowledge that they didn't want to share with anybody, because it could be obscured and made into something ugly very quickly. So they kept this very, very private. But they taught each other, and I will say more about that in my next book. Yeah, and the Cathars were massacred by the Catholic Church. That you have the Albigensian Crusade, where they killed whole cities. There were more than 2 million people who were massacred by the Catholic Church in southern France at the time. And when you travel there, especially on the Languedoc side, Provence kind of found its footing again. But on the Languedoc side towards Spain, you feel that emptiness in the land and the sadness. There's a sadness hanging over the land there, which is very, very palpable. You have Mount Segur, which was the last place where everybody got burned. It's very, very sad stories. The Celtic Church was also one of the early churches because Jesus and his family lived in England after the crucifixion and started an early church right there in Glastonbury and in that area. But it got moved over towards Ireland later because other forces came into England and it became more Catholic friendly. So they stayed more on the Irish side. And they had more of the knowledge of how to, almost like dragon knowledge from England, from China, where you understand the forces in the earth itself and how to work with that. And there are some phenomenal stories in that area. So my next book, I'm going to talk about the Cathars, I'm going to talk about the Celts, and I want to talk about the Vikings who became the protectors of the Celtic Church and all the little strange stave churches that were built in Norway later on where I believe the Celtic Church moved their knowledge from Ireland, because they knew that the Catholic Church would take them sooner or later, and they moved it to the ground of Norway, not necessarily to the people, but to the earth itself, because of those churches that were built. And that's a big, big, big thing I'm going to get. Now, what was the next thing you asked about?
The final question was, that's all so potent, I feel like you're dangling a carrot there. I can't wait for that next book.
I am. I am going to write the book, and I'm going to publish it.
But the final question was, anything, briefly, anything we haven't talked about that definitely listeners, you want them to know?
All right. All the things we've been talking about today have been totally, absolutely fascinating, but it's almost been more of a philosophical discussion, and which I love to do. That's wonderful. But all of these things are being discussed in my book. I have to put a little plug in for my book here. In Rituals in Sacred Stone, I go into then Mary Magdalene and Jesus and their education and how extremely special they were and how they knew how to work with these things and how to work with the rituals as if they're working with physical, just laws of physics from a different dimension, and how they could do that and accomplish incredible things. So I feel that in my book, I both demystified Jesus, because I'm taking him down from the cloud and down from the miracles and the abracadabra around him, but then I have remystified him in giving him these abilities that were so incredible even in our time and most likely in their time, but that is what we're supposed to learn. This is the enlightenment that he brought to us. That is the teachings that he brought to us, that we have these abilities and we can do it, and we just have to rediscover it all
and empower ourselves.
And empower
ourselves. Venka, this has been fascinating, and I would love to have you back. You've intrigued me with your other book too, Sex on the Altar.
Oh, that's a cool little book.
I'm sorry?
I'll be happy to talk about that another time.
Okay. All right. I'll email you. We'll get another date, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about everything we didn't get a chance to get into tonight. But you've just sort of left us hungry for more. So your book, please say the title again and where listeners can find it.
It's Rituals in Sacred Stone, and it's available both on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time tonight, and I look forward to having you back again. We can continue the conversation.
Well, thank you so much. I look forward to coming back.
Okay. Good night. And
good night.
Brave that weather.
Thank you. Yeah, it's still thundering around here. Very timely.
All right.
Thank you, and good night.
All right. Good night. Well, I think most of you probably know what that means. We are crossing the threshold into the second half of the show. And just a word from Joe Carson before we get to Isadora Forrest, who is up next, and I see her waiting on the switchboard. We'll be right with you, Isadora.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and divine were all connected, they were together, that there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
That's the And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Well, that was some of the dialogue from the trailer for Dancing with Gaia. It's a feature documentary about Earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the return of the goddesses Gaia. It's a great film, a sincere film that goes deep into the connections between these important topics you heard mentioned. The DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini book that expands on the material in the film, and you can get it all at dancingwithgaia.com. I want to thank Joe Carson for having me run the commercials, which help pay for the show. And please, listeners, if you're looking for something with the holidays upon us, think about Dancing with Guy. I've actually seen the film. It's very good, and so is the booklet. It's something you will probably want in your library. And I promised to tell you a bit about the Goddess Conference in Malibu last week. I gave a talk called Go Goddess, Finding Your Sacred Roar, which was well received, I think. And there were lots of other great presenters, some of which have already been on my show, and some others I'm trying to line up for December. So we might have that month dedicated to having presenters from the conference come on Voices of the Sacred Feminine and share with you what they shared at the conference. I think that might be cool, and you'd probably enjoy that. I think it's a great idea. I hope you do, too. I'm trying to get Kathy and Mike Jones from the Glastonbury Conference. The Glastonbury Temple in England, Judy Piazza, Ella Hope, Joanna Silverwich, Billawar Lee, lots of great women and men, too many to mention now. So I'm working on getting them here on the show for you. And also a big shout out goes to the organizers of Goddess Spirit Rising, Anique Radiant Heart from Down Under, Laura and Duffy from the Hands of Demeter in Southern California. What an organizational feat it was. And they did a good job, a great job. I'm looking forward to next year. And it's so awesome to have something like this down in Southern California. So thank you, ladies, for your dedication to uplifting women and men and your dedication to the sacred feminine. Women Healing the World. I want to make sure that important documentary I've been lucky enough to be a part of, I want to make sure you know that it is now available to view online. Soon I'll have a link on my website where you can actually go to access it. So please email me if you want to know more before I actually get it there on the website. Okay, next up, we have Isadora Forrest, and I thank her for her patience as we do the show's business. Let me tell you more about her, just in case you're not familiar with her extensive work in the world. I have her bio right here. Isadora has been devoted to Isis ever since the goddess told her, in no uncertain terms, that she was not yet ready to be her priestess. Isadora respects a goddess who doesn't coddle. More than 20 years and a lot of research, ritual, agony, and ecstasy later, Isadora has earned the title of prophetess in the House of Isis. She's also a priestess of the International Fellowship of Isis, a hermetic adept, a maenad for Dionysus, and a founder of the Hermetic Fellowship, a religious nonprofit devoted to education in the Western esoteric tradition. In addition to Isis magic, she is the author of Offering to Isis, Knowing the Goddess Through Her Sacred Symbols, and a contributor to the Golden Dawn Journal, series of books edited by Chick and Tabitha Cicero. Isadora lives and works in the not-at-all Egypt-like climate of Portland, Oregon, with her husband Adam Forrest, a fierce black cat, and both a temple of Isis and a grape arbor sacred to Dionysus in the backyard. Well, that's a pretty picture. Thank you, Isadora, for being on the show.
Hi, Karen. I'm glad to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm sorry I couldn't get to you sooner, but our conversation was just so rich. It went on a little bit, so I apologize for short delay.
Very interesting.
So much. You wanted to talk a little bit about Mary Magdalene, too, and the old mystery schools before we get to Isis, I think.
Not my field, actually. Magdalene, I do not know from Mary Magdalene. But I do know from mysteries and perhaps a little mystery schools, if you consider the philosophical schools as mystery schools.
Oh, okay. Well, my apologies. I think I probably misread something that an email that we shared. But so Isis, goddess of initiation. Why don't you start by saying what you mean by that, just in case it's not clear to listeners? How is Isis the goddess of initiation, the great initiatrix?
Well, in your previous conversation, you all touched on the idea of mystery schools. And I'd like to maybe expand a little bit on the idea of the ancient mysteries, one of which the famous ones is the mysteries of Isis. But usually when we talk about the ancient mysteries, we're talking about a few of the very famous, very, very well-known ones, such as the Eleusinian Mysteries, the Mithraic Mysteries, the Dionysian Mysteries, and certainly the Mysteries of Isis. And what those mysteries were secrets of ritual. And I remember in your conversation earlier, you all were talking about, you know, what do we know and what do we not know about the mysteries. And the cool thing and the beautiful thing, I think, is that we really don't know a lot about the ancient mysteries. We have hints, but all of the initiates were sworn to secrecy, and they were entirely serious about it. And they kept their vow. They kept their promises. So a lot of the hints that we have are either from hostile sources who were not initiates and who are speculating, or perhaps converts who had been and, you know, were not concerned with revealing the mysteries, the secrets of the mysteries. So one of the wonderful things about the mysteries of Isis is that there is only one, and this is fictional, but most scholars think that it's based on reality. There is only one first-person account of initiation into any of the ancient mysteries, and that is an account by a writer called Apuleius on his initiation, or his character's initiation, into the mysteries of Isis.
Well, I'm familiar with that story a bit. You know, he's turned into an ass. And
yes.
Then then Isis turns him back into a man. But what, you know, what does that all mean?
Well, I mean, you can take it pretty literally is, you know, the guy's no longer an ass. He has had his eyes opened. And
okay.
The reason, I mean, the name of the book is Metamorphoses, and it's most commonly known as the Golden Ass, because he's turned into an ass, but because of what he learns during his experiences as an ass. Can we say that on Blog Talk Radio?
I think so.
Because of his experiences as an ass, he learns things, and thus he becomes golden. But the reason he got into trouble in the first place is that he was messing around with magic when he didn't know what he was doing. He had a slave girl who was the servant of a Thessalian witch. And the Thessalian witches were like the famous witches of antiquity. If you wanted a witch, you went to Thessaly. So this girl was the slave girl of a Thessalian witch. And so she, of course, had been listening in on her mistress. And he was in love with the slave girl. Her name is Fotis. I always like to name the female characters in books, because very often in ancient sources, you know, they're all written by men, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have the wife did this. And so if we have the name, I like to say, so Fotis is her name. And she's her character. And she is the one who knows the magic. And a spell goes wrong. He's supposed to be turning into an owl, I believe, so that he can go fly around and see things and, you know, be amazed by the magic. And by mistake, he's turned into an ass.
A beast of burden.
Yes. And, you know, all the reputation of the donkey for being a rather randy character.
Mm-hmm.
So the story is in 11 books, I believe. And Isis doesn't appear until the last book. But the first 10 are kind of the story of how this happened and then his adventures as an ass. He passes from, you know, one bad master to another.
So it almost like Black Beauty, when you think of it. That just sort of hit me in an instant. You know, Black Beauty sort of goes from one bad master to another. So do you think then maybe metaphorically some of the story is about how he – you know, basically just learns about life, his journey through life. Maybe he gains wisdom, he gains empathy, he gains insight. And in doing so, you know, he just evolves, and that is his metamorphosis. Could it be as simple as that, or you think there's more to it?
Oh, I think it definitely could be. I mean, one of the key scenes is after all these terrible adventures, some of them bawdy, some of them just, you know, awful, as he's worn out, he's desperate, he's just like, oh, kill me now. So he goes down to the sea, bathes ritually in the sea, and the moon is coming up. And he prays to the moon goddess. He doesn't know what her name is. He says, you know, by whatever name it is right to call you, whether you're Diana or Artemis or da-da-da-da-da, you know, please help me. And he falls asleep. And in his dream, the goddess rises out of the sea. And, you know, there's a long description of, you know, what she looks like and what she's crowned with and what she's wearing. And she says, you know, you've called upon me on the correct names, but my true name is Queen Isis. And she gives him an eratology of what's going on and says, now you need to be initiated into my mysteries. So he wakes up knowing that he's got to be initiated into her mysteries. And she has, in fact, told a priest of hers to find him and, you know, make sure this thing happens. And that's exactly what, in fact, does happen to him. He goes.
So,
mm-hmm.
Well, and you know, and I don't mean to get ahead of you here, but I'm you know trying to connect the dots for myself and for listeners, and I'm thinking, you know, this is kind of a, well, maybe you could say condensed. I mean, obviously, he goes through all of these books that didn't happen in a short period of time. It went. You know, that happened to him over a long period of time. Would it be too much of a stretch to say that the mystery schools are sort of a metaphor for just our journey in life? If we are a person that's trying to evolve spiritually and become a better human being, you know, in other words, it's not one ritual held one day. It's really what we learn through our lifetime. And, you know, maybe could that have been what was also being taught in the mystery schools?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about the mystery schools as perhaps the philosophical schools, and actually remind me of the word theurgy in just a minute here, because
okay.
It relates to the conversation that you just had. But there certainly were many schools at the time, and let's say this is, you know, first, second century CE, which is, the second century CE is kind of like the height of when the Isis religion spread throughout the Mediterranean area. And there were lots of people at that time, partially fueled by the ancient mysteries, who were spiritual seekers. They were looking for a personal connection with deity. And that was something that the mysteries gave them a taste of. And then if they were well-to-do and had the time to do it, and, you know, it was mostly people who had money, sorry to say, who were able to attend what you might call the mystery schools or the philosophical schools. And they, you know, they indeed took lessons on philosophy, on religion, I've connected myself back up to theurgy, so let me go there.
Okay.
Your previous guest mentioned working with God rather than worshiping.
Right.
Well, I think she's probably referring to a particular school of thought called theorgia in Greek, and we Englishize it as theurgy, and it means God working or divine working. And the idea with theurgy is that it's a ritual path to, I guess, knowledge and conversation with the deities. And it was one of the philosophical schools, and certainly I would say that it was one of the mystery schools.
So what type of rituals, I mean, do we know what they, you know, what they actually did in, you know, these theurgy, you know, path workings?
We do know some of them. They did a lot of purification. They did invocation of the divine into themselves. So you would invoke a god or goddess into yourself. Very often they did oracular workings. Hecate and Apollo, being great oracular deities, were part of that. I don't have any information that Isis was part of the theurgical schools, but I wouldn't be surprised. We have so little from that period, but, you know, we have no evidence of it.
Mm-hmm.
we do have evidence of with her as part of the Hermetic schools, which are very much related. There's a text called the Kore Kosmu, or the Virgin of the World, which is an ancient Hermetic text, and the texts were kind of in the form of a teaching dialogue. So you would have a teacher and a student talking together, which was kind of the form for the schools. That's how you would learn, you know, Socratic teaching, question mm-hmm. and answer among teacher and student. Well, in this one, Isis is teaching Horus, and she's teaching him all about life, the universe, and everything. And that puts her firmly in the Hermetic school of teaching and philosophy.
Okay. And, then as far as Isis as, the initiatrix, can't get the word out. how would you recommend people today work with her as the initiatrix?
That reminded me, I was thinking about that before our call started here, and I've talked to a lot of Isis priestesses, and I believe they have encountered a form of the goddess, which I have jokingly called Isis the ass kicker, speaking of asses, and not in the other way.
Right,
not in
right.
the golden ass way.
Right.
Because I have a very fond memory of, like, I'm downstairs in the temple with, you know, a couple other priestesses, and we're like yakking about Isis. And every single one of them said, oh, yes, she made me do this. And the other one said, oh, yeah, she pretty much kicked my ass until I did this. And that seems to be something that she does modernly. It's in a very kindly way. It's in a very motherly way. But it's in a way that you will not ignore. She just keeps bringing it up, whatever it is that you need to do. You
right.
need to, I don't know, quit smoking. You need to get, you know, a healthier lifestyle. You need to write me a book. You need to
right.
learn how to do ritual better. You need to get over this thing in your life. You know, if you have, like, a psychological thing that you need to deal with, she will bring it to your attention and say, I love you, dear, but you really need to deal
tough
with
love.
It.
Yeah, she's sort of the goddess of tough love. Well, you know, I sort of think of it as she just inspires us to be the best version of ourselves we can be.
Yeah, and very often she keeps bringing that up, that thing up that's not quite the best we can be that we need to work on.
So
and
she,
so, really
so
that,
you're
I
saying
really
she
like
basically initiates. She's sort of the catalyst to cause us to start down these roads of change, of metamorphosis.
I mean, today we don't have the luxury of having established mystery schools or philosophical schools. There, I mean, certainly there are teaching covens and things like that are more around, and there's the Fellowship of Isis, which is dedicated to her, but has really a broad trajectory. But if we're looking, you know, if we're looking for initiation, very often I think people interact with the goddess themselves. She comes to them and says, "Here I am. I'm going to initiate you either on your spiritual path or in this thing you need to do." And that's, you know, that's a modern way that she serves as initiatrix. She gets us started on what we need to do.
Well, you know, I don't know if it was something you sent me or it, actually maybe it was my last guest, I can't remember now, but someone was talking, sent me something that said Isis seems to work with people in dreams. That she does a lot of teaching in dreams. Could that have been from you, or do you find that that's true?
Oh, it's very consistent. I mean, you find that, in the story about Lucius and the initiation that
mm-hmm.
I was telling, he could not be initiated until he'd had the proper dream. The priest he was working with, whose name was Mithras, another deity, kept having to counsel him to just, you know, calm down, be quiet, wait, it will happen when it happens, because he could not be initiated until he had the dream where Isis came to him and said, okay, you're ready, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
And when he
mm-hmm.
finally had that dream, then, you know, all the ceremonies could proceed with due form. But, yeah, I think she does. With me personally, not so much in dream because I'm very bad at dreams. I trained myself in vision. So most of my work is done in a dreamlike state, but it's a visionary state rather than an actual sleeping state.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly when I'm sleeping, it's just like, please don't talk to me. Let me sleep. But, yeah,
well,
I think for a lot of people, she does come in dream.
Well, and, you know, and honestly, I'm not a good dreamer either. And, you know, my believe it or not, my experience with her has been more physical happenings, you know. I don't know if it's because, you know, for myself, you know, I'm much more left brain than right brain, and I tend to, and I know I shouldn't, I'm working on it, I tend to discount those right brain messages that come, you know. So I find that some of the most important things, I think, that have happened to me, she has literally sent me a sign, you know. Like when my, maybe like when one of, I was 1 foot out the door, she would send me something so incredibly tangible that even I couldn't miss it, you know, and I couldn't deny it or talk myself out of it and tell myself I was, it was just a delusion.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds like her.
yeah, absolutely.
And if you didn't see it the first time, she would come around and bring it up and go, you know this thing I showed you? I'm showing it to you again.
Yes. I call it being hit between the eyes with a clue by four. You know, it usually happens like 3 times before I pay attention. And then by the 4th time, I'm thinking, oh, gee, should I have been paying attention to that? But you know, I sometimes also think about, you know, Sekhmet has always been the other deity that I feel like called me as well. And sometimes I haven't been able to tell the difference between those tough love lessons. I you know, don't always know whether they're coming from Isis or Sekhmet, or I think they're those that in the temple at Philae. Aren't they sort of, you know, the two goddesses or sort of considered almost one?
Well,
you know,
certainly in some places. I mean, what I really like about the whole Egyptian pantheon is that it is so interconnected. Is you've got, you know, X deity is the Ba, or the soul of another deity, and this deity is in that deity. And to me, that reflects a kind of true divine reality, is that the deities they flow a little bit. And
mm-hmm.
so, yes, you would see Isis and Sekhmet put together. Philae, yeah, is the big one where I think she's even called specifically Sekhmet in some of the poems, some of the hymns on the temple walls.
Yeah, because down there, I mean, Philae was like at the border of the empire. It was kind of that, you know, temple on the outskirts of everything, you know, sort of, you know, protecting the empire from the Netherland. So she was, you know, maybe Isis was more of a warrior goddess there. And I know, you know, Sekhmet, you know, some people thought of her that way, too. So, I know
they wanted
to think
a fierce goddess.
Yeah, fierce protectress that, you know, they could feel safe. Well, I think one of the things you wanted to chat about was, were the Roman mysteries Egyptian at all?
It's a very interesting question. You know, I was talking earlier about kind of the mysteries, excuse me, in the ancient world, and it's true that there is nothing in Egyptian tradition that's exactly like the established mysteries. Sorry about that. I've got
little
tickle. But there are, I wouldn't be surprised if what grew into the great mysteries of the Mediterranean were not at least seeded by the Egyptian death experience, really. Generally, the mysteries were about, you know, life and death and finding some kind of afterlife, some promise of life after death, Well, the Egyptians had been doing that for many thousands of years. And so we have, you know, the books of the dead that tell you, you know, what words to say and what's going to happen and what spells to use and that sort of thing. And we find a really good parallel with that is in the Bacchic and Orphic mysteries. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but they're known as the Bacchic or Orphic gold leaves. Mm-hmm. And they were not as big as the books of the dead that the Egyptians had buried with them. But they were, in fact, very small, flat gold, like gold leaf, but often shaped like a leaf, like a grape leaf or something like that. And they would incise verses on them. And they were things like, you may have heard of this, I'm a child of earth and starry heaven, and, you know, I've come for, give me cold water from this well of memory. Well, that is so reminiscent of the Egyptian books of the dead that I've got to think that there's a connection between those two things.
Okay.
So that people learned when they wanted to know that there was life after death, who did they look to? They looked to the Egyptians and those mysteries. So my thought is that, and I guess I'm not the only one, and the scholars that I've read think that a lot of the mystery cult may have at least been inspired by the Egyptian mysteries, because the Egyptians had it so knocked that everybody said, well, look at those guys, you know, they've got it right. When you look at the books of the dead, and then you look at some of the things that the mystery initiates had to do, you had to know secret words. You had to undergo certain experiences. You had to walk certain paths. And you find those same things in the books of the dead, and then you find them in the hints that we have of what happened in some of the general Mediterranean mysteries. So I think it's an interesting parallel. And while you can't say that Egypt had the same sort of mysteries, that was sort of a Greek invention, the mysteries, mm-hmm. but that there is an Egyptian antecedent and something that's pretty darn parallel, and that's the after-death experience.
Well, and you can't deny that they had to influence each other. I mean, you know, there was travel back and forth, and so many people went to the Alexandrian Library. I mean, it would almost seem impossible to think that they didn't influence each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Egypt was feeding Rome, you know.
Egypt was this great, you know, amazing mystical thing. I mean, I'm imagining how Egypt was perceived. It was so ancient. It was so magical. It was so mystical that people sent, you know, their children to be educated there.
Right.
Let me tell a story. I will tell a story of someone being educated in Egypt, and it does have to do with ISIS.
Okay.
I'll preface this by saying I just came back from the Esoteric Book Conference in Seattle this past weekend, which was mm-hmm. awesome, by the way. Shout out to Esoteric Book Conference. one thing I do want to say is, ladies, those of you who have written books of an esoteric nature, they need more female speakers. It was like me and one other woman.
Okay.
So, come on down, girls. Okay. So this was in my talk that I gave on Isis as goddess of magicians. So here's the story. It's told by a fellow named Lucian, and he wrote a book called Philosudes, which translates as Lover of Lies. And the whole book is about these group of friends who've gathered at a friend's house. The friend is ill, and they're entertaining their pal by telling stories about haunted houses and magic and, you know, interaction with the deities. And the sick guy is like, oh, eating this up, because he is, quote, the lover of lies. Well, this story is told by the host himself. His name is Eucrates, and he swears it's all true. He says when he was a youth, his father sent him to Egypt to be educated. And he was on a boat traveling up to Memphis, I do believe. He was going to go see the oracle at Memnon. And while on the boat, he met a scribe of one of the temples at Memphis. The scribe's name was Pankratis, and he was big magician priest. And apparently they hit it off, and the magician priest says, well, you know, come on home, I'll teach you. And he says, oh, but there's one thing. You really don't need to bring your servants. Leave your servants in Memphis. Come on to my house. You know, I'll teach you some things. They'll be fine. Well, this puzzles our Greek Eucrates because, well, he's an upper crust guy and he's used to having his servants around, but he says, okay, I'll trust you and leave my servants here in Memphis. So they travel back to the magician's house, and exactly what he said turned out to be true, because anytime anything needed to be done, the magician would take up a stick of wood, he'd clothe it as if it were a human being, he would speak some magic words over it, and instantly the stick would come to life and start doing whatever needed doing. Well, the magician taught Eucrates many things, but he did not teach him this particular secret. So, of course, the guy spied on him, and he overheard the magic words that bring the broom to life. And while the magician was out one day, he says, okay, I'm going to try this. So he does. He clothes a broom, and he speaks the magic words, and poof, instantly the serpent comes to life. And he says, go fetch water. And it does. And it fetches water, and it fetches water, and it fetches water, and it fetches water. And you're probably starting to think, ah, I know this story. But it gets worse because he doesn't know the magic words to make it stop. So he tries force instead. So he takes the broom, he breaks it in two. Okay, now he's got two servants bringing water, and the house is floating. Yes, you have recognized it. It's Fantasia, the Walt Disney story where the broom is bringing water and Mickey is the sorcerer's apprentice. This
okay.
is an ancient story. And the connection with Isis is that the magician priest learned his magic after studying for 23 years in the underground temples and learning from the goddess of magic herself, Isis.
Ah, yes, Isis, the lady of magic.
Disney forgot that part.
Right. Well, and how does Isis, you know, become the Lady of Magic? Where does that actually start? Because Hathor is on the scene before Isis, isn't she?
Well, as far back as we have any record, she's always been connected with magic. But in fact, all the deities are. That's the power that they have. That's the energy of the universe. Magic, Heka, is what makes everything happen. It's kind of the core energy of the universe, life, everything that happens is made by magic.
Well, do you think that they perceived Isis as being more powerful than some of the other deities, that she got the title Lady of Magic, or maybe some of the other deities actually share that title as well?
Some of them do, but it pretty much comes down to Isis and Thoth as god and goddess of magic.
Mm-hmm.
They are the ones that have come down in legend as kind of the most powerful ones. So they share that title. But certainly,
so does that sort of tie into her relation to nature? Because, you know, magic is usually, you know, is really using the energies of the universe.
There, I think it's a core energy. There's a story that magic is the first thing that the creator Re Atu made, and he's the one, because he is a living being. He's the one that empowers all the others. So it's kind of like he's a vibrating force that underlies everything else. And we all, human beings too, have magic. It's just that the gods and goddesses have more than we do.
Well, you know, one story about Isis that always sort of intrigues me is when she tricks Ra into revealing his name. And isn't that when she's supposed to actually become more powerful? Am I remembering the story right?
You do. That is when you have just hit upon one of my issues.
Because, you know, she seems, you know, she doesn't act with the best of integrity there. And that's all. And I always thought, are we getting the story wrong or am I missing something? You know, she seems a little bit conniving, and I don't like to see Isis in that light. So I'm wondering, what am I missing?
Yes, I will give, as with you, that the explanation that she was just power seeking doesn't really work for me. Here's what I think. I don't think we need. Do we need to tell the story?
Maybe briefly, so listeners are on the same page with us.
Okay. Here's the story. This story seems to be one of the most bothersome for Issyax as we're kind of learning our lore, because Isis seems to be rather underhanded in this whole situation. So here's the story. She is pondering in her heart how she could become even more powerful than she already is, even though she knows everything in heaven and earth. And she decides that the way to do this is to gain the secret name of Rei, who in this particular story is kind of like the power of the universe. Rei is rather old, and he's drooling as he goes across the sky, which is not a good thing for a ruler. So she picks up some of this drool, and she kneads it with earth, and she creates a holy serpent. And the next day, as he comes across the sky, she puts this holy serpent in his path. It bites him. And, you know, the poison, the text says, the poison rushes through Rei like the Nile rushes through Egypt, which I think is a wonderful description of that. Well, he's never felt such pain, and he goes on complaining about his pain for many, many long paragraphs. Eventually, he ends up calling to his children, say, you know, bring to me my children who have magic in their mouths and can help cure me of this thing that has bitten me. I don't know what it is. Obviously, I didn't create it. And so they come, and they're weeping. And, of course, Isis comes as well, and she says, what happened? What's going on here? You tell me your name, and you shall be healed. And he goes on about, I am the king, and I've done this, and when I open my eyes, the sun shines. When I close my eyes, it is dark. And goes on and on and on and on. And she says, what you have said is not your name. Tell me your name, for he who says his name shall live. And this goes on, and eventually the pain is so great that Rei says, okay, I will give you my name. He vacates the boat of the millions of years. They go away in secret. And a very interesting detail in the text, it says that his name passes from his body into her body. So there's this physical aspect of the name and the magic that passes into her. And by the way, she also makes him promise that he shall give to her son Horus the sun and the moon, his two eyes. And then she cures him. Poof. It works just as she said. Well, a lot of people are very disturbed by this story, me included, when I first heard it. So I started thinking about it. I say, okay, what's going on here? This is from a reasonably late text. The story that we have that's kind of the primary text for this is like 20th dynasty. In Egyptian terms, that's not super ancient. But most of these stories in Egypt go way, 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 way back, further than the records that we have of them. So my assumption is that this is a really, really ancient story. And if you ever looked at some of the texts and things from Egypt, you'll find like scribal notes in the margins, because these stories are so old, even the scribes don't understand them. So they make notes, which they call glosses, and they say, this means XYZ, and this means XYZ. So I'm imagining this scribe reading this story going, what the heck? Why is Isis doing this? Well, it must have been a divine power play. So he makes a note about that, and that's how the story comes down to us. Hmm. But in my imagination and in my theory, my personal theory, that's not what's going on here. So Do you mind if I it's going to take me a minute or two to kind of get to the point. Is that
No, no, no. Go ahead. Working? Go ahead.
Okay. So, let's look at what we've got here. We have the old king. He's so old that he drools. Now, remember that the king is supposed to be the epitome of physical and spiritual power. Having a ruler so old that he drools is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
We also have the goddess of renewal. Isis is, she has always been known as the goddess of transformation and renewal. That is kind of the key thing with Egyptian magic is renewal, going back to the first time, to the primal time when everything was perfect. Another thing that we've got is the saliva of the gods. Now, in Egyptian magic, almost any bodily fluid could be used for magic, and it was super powerful. So if human saliva was powerful enough to do magic, think what it would mean to have the saliva of a god.
Right.
And she takes this up, and Isis doesn't let this drooled-out power go to waste. Instead, she mixes it with earth. Earth is the place of renewal. And this snake will eventually cause the god to be healed. But for now, you know, it's this serpent, which has always been a symbol of renewal, being able to shed its skin. We also have name magic. This story has been used as kind of the typical example of name magic in Egyptian myth. This tells you how powerful the name was to the ancient Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
It symbolized something that if you knew the name, you knew the essential core power at the time of creation, which was the time when everything was perfect, so that
mm-hmm.
you could access this ancient and eternal energy. So you put all that together, and what has happened is the goddess of renewal has taken up her charge. She says, I'm the one who causes renewal. The god is old. This will not do. It will not do to have an ancient sun going across the sky. He needs to be renewed. What can I do to make this happen? Well, she uses the symbol of his own degeneration, the saliva, mixed with the earth, which is recreational, and then the serpent, which is also a symbol of renewal, that bites him. His own weakness strikes him and causes him more pain than he's ever seen or felt before. And he finds out that in order to be healed, he has to make himself vulnerable to the divine. He has to open himself entirely so that Isis can heal him by knowing his most inner self, his name.
Hmm. So
and
really,
in no
you could
other
look
myth,
at it as her duty or even mercy,
yeah,
in a way.
Exactly. And in no other myth that I know of that has come to light so far do we ever find her abusing the power. Yeah, she gains the power and she heals him with it, but there's never any hint that she's abusing that power. So that's another thing that says to me is like, oh, this is kind of the natural way of things, is what
yeah,
happens
yeah.
The god renews you.
Right, right, right. Well, we probably only have about 5 more minutes, Isadora. Our time has really flown. And I don't know if you can answer this in that time, but another Egyptian story that always had me puzzled and disturbed me was Nephthys, unless, you know, we're using contemporary mores and they don't apply to, you know, these ancient myths, but how Nephthys, you know, tricks Osiris into, you know, having him think that she was Isis and she becomes pregnant with Anubis. Is there a story there? Or, like I said, or am I just putting contemporary mores on an ancient myth?
Well, I think what that one shows us is that Osiris has a relationship with kind of both sides of Isis, the dark and the light, the two
mm-hmm.
sisters who are really one sister, and you know he has the relationship with Isis, and their child is the bright Horus, and he has a relationship with Nephthys, and their child is the dark Anubis, and so by having the relationship with both sisters, everything is complete. The cycle
and
is
imbalance.
Complete. Dark and light. And there's a lovely in the. Are you familiar with the Greco-Egyptian magical papyri?
No, I'm not.
They're a collection of magical texts that are fairly late in origin. The big cache of them came from an Egyptian town called Oxyrhynchus, and they think they were a magician's stash, basically. And in some of those, there is a term for this dual goddess who's both Isis and Nephthys, and they just combine the names and they call her Isoneptis, which I think is gorgeous.
Yeah, and it would make sense with the explanation you just gave is as well. You know, it's really two sides of one goddess in a sense.
They're sisters. They're so close that they are
right.
That they are one.
Well, I don't want you to leave, and time is slipping away. I don't want you to leave without telling listeners about the new edition of Isis Magic.
Oh, I would be thrilled to do that. Yes,
please
do. We're calling it the 10th anniversary edition, although it's slightly longer than 10 years since the last edition of Isis Magic. It's been out of print for quite a number of years, and over the years, it's just unbelievable how many people have written to me saying, I can't pay $200 for this thing, which is what the used ones were selling for. But, scalpers. My co-publisher says scalpers. But we have finally republished a brand new edition. The second edition is the 10th anniversary edition. It is a beautiful new edition with a fantastic new index, and we've did corrections and fix things that didn't make me happy the first time around. We now have footnotes rather than endnotes, so if you want to check sources and research things for yourself, you can just look to the bottom of the page. Yay!
Mm-hmm.
And there are some new rituals and new meditations. And so even if you have the old edition, you may want to get a new edition as well.
Okay.
And it is available on Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah. And also at the publisher's site, which is abiagnushouse.com.
You better spell that.
I will spell that because it's weird. It's A-B-I-E-G-N-U-S and then house.com.
Okay.
And speaking of initiation, Abi Ignis is the Rosicrucian Mountain of Initiation, so that's why we have named our company after that.
Oh, so it's your publishing company?
It is.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Oh, thanks. Oh, and may I invite listeners to visit me on my blog as well?
Sure.
Yep. I am at isiopolis.com, which is I-S-I-O-P-O-L-I-S. It's just Isio and polis, as in town. It means, city of Isis. And if you just Google that or something close to it, you'll find me.
It's a great site. I go there occasionally and take a look. Well,
thanks.
Isadora, I am so sorry. We have like 2 minutes left before we go off the air. I want to thank you for being on the show. You're welcome back anytime. Isis is always a favorite of mine to talk about, and you're such a fount of information. I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with all of us.
Oh, it's great talking to you, Karen, and someday I'll see you in the flesh.
I hope so. I sure hope so.
Me too.
Well, thank you so very much, and be well, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Have a wonderful evening, and thank you so much for the work you do, Karen.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, she keeps hitting me on the head. You know, we have to do what she tells us, so.
Isis the kicker.
yep, the great initiatrix. We love her. All right. Well, thank you, Isadora. Good night.
All right, good night.
Well, remember, listeners, you can catch any show from the archives. You can listen via iTunes as well. And as I always say, thank you so much for being the gas in my tank. I will be having a special show on Monday to make up for being away earlier in the month, so tune in next week on Monday and Wednesday, or as always, catch us from the archives. And I would like to leave you with this quote from Monique Wittig in the waning seconds here. There was a time when you were not a slave. Remember that. You walked alone, full of laughter. You bathed bare-bellied. You say you have lost all recollection of it. Remember. You say there were no words to describe this time. You say it does not exist, but remember. Make an effort to remember, or failing that, invent. Well, good night, listeners. Have a wonderful week, and thank you for your listenership, and I will be back with you on Monday. Good night.